Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
They are a very big source of corn exports. Russia is a big source of wheat exports. And in both countries, I had a professor once who says, you got to slice the apple in a lot of different ways to really understand what's going on the inside. And if you look at Ukraine and Russia as a share of global production, they're pretty small. But both of those countries export a majority of their corn and wheat production.
Ag economist David Widmar, co-founder of Agricultural Economic Insights.
In Ukraine, it's about 80% of their corn goes for exports. And so this means they're about, 16 to 20% of globally traded corn. And so markets are having a hard time wrapping their minds around what are going to be the implications of this as they move forward.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
So when we see something like those slacks or denim jeans in the marketplace, remember, every bale is approximately 220 pairs of jeans. So anytime we can create these types of product programs, we're moving pounds and bales of cotton. And that's the goal. Get cotton in there, replace the synthetics, or in markets where we have the lead and there's a lot of cotton used, we want to preserve that share of market.
That's Mark Masura. He's head of the Global Supply Chain Marketing Division with Cotton Incorporated.
Well, what's also interesting when we think about what's hidden in plain sight is what the average consumer does. And here you see an example of a lady shopping. And this is typical of what most consumers will do. They'll touch the fabric and they'll look at the style. They'll look at the color. But what's really key here is what her hand is doing. She's touching the fabric. But what we really want to do is make sure consumers not only touch it to make sure it's soft and comfortable, but we want them to actually look inside and check the label. And that's what a lot of our consumer advertising is aimed at, is getting that awareness to check the label. And we have a terrific market research department at Cotton Incorporated. And we do a lot of work to find out how many consumers are actually checking these labels. That's a good proxy or a good indicator for us of whether or not fiber content is important. If you don't look for the label, it doesn't matter to you, then fiber content may not be important. If your product doesn't perform or comes apart in the wash or gets a lot of little pills or little deformation in the fabric, then you might start paying attention to what it's made of. But we want to be proactive and get consumers to look for cotton and buy and search for the cotton products. So what we find and what our market research group at Cotton Incorporated has found is that in the U.S. market, 43% of consumers will always or usually check the label. And that's pretty good. That's pretty good. We'd like to see it higher, but that's a pretty good number. But there are differences when you look a little further. So let's look at how men and women shop. And I think we would all agree there are differences by gender. We see men typically being a little more brand loyal. Female shoppers tend to be more willing to look at different brands, more fashion styles. But whether they're shopping in different ways, ultimately, we want to make sure men and women are checking a label. And here we see a little higher propensity of men to check the label. Another way we can look at this is by age. And when you think about our marketing program, certainly at the consumer level, but also when we're talking to companies about marketing something like boys' pants or girls' leggings, it's important to know what the products are made of. And we see that consumers here at certain age levels have different awareness. What this statistic tells us is that while younger consumers, teens and 20s primarily, may not be checking that label as much, certainly the mothers and the dads who are buying product are more likely to check that. So when Jen talked about crafting marketing messages and working with brands and retailers, this is the kind of information and the kind of market insight that goes into helping our marketing teams develop the right kind of marketing strategies and call outs and promotions that can feature cotton and really resonate with what consumers are looking for.
Mark Masura is the head of Global Supply Chain Marketing with Cotton Incorporated. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
The rest of the world is moving in a way where not only is blockchain providing the technology as a tool to be able to understand what's going on, but it's giving us the ability to learn how to work.
Louis Macias is CEO of GrainChain, talking about blockchain basics and why it's secure and good for ag.
We've all heard the buzzword of blockchain, and the first thing everyone thinks of is Bitcoin. And while blockchain is the technology that supports Bitcoin, it should be the technology that supports your corn. It should be the technology that supports your bank. And it should be the technology that supports the food that you're eating every day. Why is that? Because I can trust the technology, which is a big difference. And blockchain is all about trust. For those of you who don't understand what it is, I'm going to just very, very quickly talk about how it works. I, as a person, am wearing a blue shirt. And I've told you that I'm wearing this blue shirt, and I've written it down on a piece of paper. And this piece of paper has been written down and distributed to 1,000 people. And everyone knows that I have a blue shirt. But the markets have changed. And red shirts are worth a lot more. And I'm going to change my shirt to a red shirt and say that it was red. But now I've got to convince 1,000 different people that it was red. And I've already written down it on paper. And that's not going to happen. And what blockchain technology does is it distributes this information to so many different computers that it writes it down in stone. It's our digital stone. So now that we can trust it, now we know that that's not going to change. So if my friend over here who is collecting carbon credits writes this information down, puts it into stone, certifies it, and 5 years later, a company comes and asks them to prove what he did, there it is. What does that have to do with a financial transaction, and why are banks investing in it tremendously and different governments investing in it? Because they're able to trust the data. They're able to understand what it is. You need to create an infrastructure around it, and that's what GrainChain is doing, is providing different tools to be able to input the correct data into the blockchain. But now that I have the right data, I can execute a contract. So now when I told you that a grain truck went up to an elevator at 11 and got paid within seconds, it's because it trusted the data enough to be able to do it, and it moved the money fast enough to be able to let you walk out of that elevator with money already deposited in your bank account. And that's happened to us hundreds of thousands of times in the last couple of years, which is something that has benefited us and our users tremendously. When we understand that because this technology gives us a true immutability, and we're able to validate that information, we're able to take action. We're not only able to move money, we're able to recognize, we're able to certify, and we're able to understand where things come from. But more than anything else, you own this data. You select who sees the data. You give people the keys to see your information. And you select who has the opportunity to pay you for your data, which is what's the most important thing. Because us as individuals are turning into a digital world where that data is extremely valuable. That data is what is going to give us the ability to get paid. It's for people to understand what work was done and how we were moving.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
So when we talk about what influences the weather, what are the big things that really drive weather across North America, the biggest part of it really is still what is ENSO, or the El Nino Southern Oscillation.
John Brannick is an ag meteorologist with DTN.
It's just kind of a fancy term for just saying whether we're in El Nino, La Nina, or neither. Neutral is neither. El Nino is the positive side of that. La Nina is the antithesis, the negative side of that. You've probably heard that term over and over and over again, as we've basically been in a La Nina pattern for the last two winters. Polar vortex still has some influence over the spring, but it's waning as we get towards summertime. The polar vortex, again, is another one of those hot-button terms that just gets floated around every so often. But it really just describes the jet stream that moves around the pole. And when it's strong, all the cold air stays locked up towards the pole. And when it's weak, some of the, we get those bigger cold shots that come through. So the one coming through now, not here, obviously, but up in Minnesota and for the rest of the country, and over the next couple of days is actually an extension of the polar vortex moving through. We have pretty fair skill at forecasting the polar vortex for about 5 to 6 weeks, but it trails off after that. El Nino, if I back up here a little bit, the ENSO picture, we actually do pretty good at forecasting temperatures in the Pacific Ocean for about 4 or 5 months. After that, it trails off quite significantly, and there's actually something, and we're in a special time of year, where we call it the spring predictability barrier. Basically, models do a worse job in spring at predicting what's going to happen with ENSO than at any other time of the year. And for whatever reason, what we don't understand, that just seems to be the case. Another big thing is just everything left over, and we call those sub-seasonal factors. You can think of those as soil moisture, snow cover, cloud cover, actually thunderstorm complexes over the Pacific Ocean, all have an influence on what's going to happen in our weather, and those things are really hard to predict more than just a couple of weeks out, so we have pretty low skill at that. And that's actually a pretty good chunk of what makes up and what drives spring weather here in North America. And this is a little bit more than what it is over the wintertime season, so these sorts of things lead us to lower confidence, and why we have to talk in generalities about the forecast instead of saying it's going to be 76 degrees on May 15th. We just can't do that. Nobody can do that. And if they are telling you they can do that, they're lying to you. And then the last kind of 20% is basically the trends. You can think of that of climate change, but really it's just how has temperature and precipitation evolved over the last couple of decades in your area. And obviously we have good at skill at that because we have all that data.
And what about the outlook?
You can kind of see here in May where we got the highest anomalies kind of over Texas, Oklahoma. It kind of creates this kind of bubble. And if you know about how weather works, it means we've got a ridge of high pressure across the southern plains. Well, that's got a weakness there across the northern portions of the country. And what we like, or what thunderstorms like to do, is they like to ride the northern ridge, the northern side of the ridge. And so when we go back to precipitation, we can see them kind of starting that way, where we get thunderstorms in Montana, in the Dakotas, and they ride over the top of that ridge and then down into the eastern Midwest and into the East Coast as well. So that's what I'm seeing for what's going on in May, which means some variability in precipitation across the Dakotas, the upper Midwest, but some better chances for rainfall in May. So if you've got the seed in the ground in May, you're probably in a pretty good shape out there. If you have to wait, you might have to wait even a little bit longer, pushing June, and that's not a good time for anybody.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
How we're approaching and getting in front of those brands.
It's Jen Lukowiak with Cotton Incorporated on how CI chooses brands to partner with.
So again, it could be at a trade show. It could be a brand that we've had a lot of connectivity with maybe years prior. You know, again, kind of coming in and out of this pandemic, things are, there are different people in different positions within these organizations. So it's connecting possibly at a trade show, an industry event. It's keeping up with those contacts and making sure we understand where they've moved to. Somebody who was an executive at the Gap yesterday might be an executive at Target tomorrow. You know, so you really have to understand where these people are going. It really is very, very, very rooted in good, strong, communicative relationships. And the team is fantastic with knowing where these players are and how we need to get in touch and involved with them in keeping them engaged. Inviting them to things like workshops, webinars. Again, always kind of getting Cotton and Cotton Technologies out in front of them. It comes down at the end of the day to communication and making sure that the communication is good and strong and compelling and engaging. And the team is really great at that.
Mark Masura heads up Cotton Incorporated's Global Supply Chain Marketing Division. On other areas when looking for partners?
There are a couple other kind of things that we look for. Number one, we'll call this the swimsuit example. We're not working to get Cotton into swimsuits. Why not? There's no cotton there. Yeah, but comparatively, there's also very little fiber. So a product category like that doesn't represent a good opportunity for our time. So if we're looking at apparel, we're looking at how to keep cotton and preserve high use in denim jeans, because we know people have multiple pairs of jeans. And if that goes toward polyester or Tencel or rayon or something else, that's a huge loss for cotton. So volume is one of the things that we look at. But sometimes it's also finding market leaders. So when we see a shift of younger people maybe moving away from denim toward things like leggings, we know that that's a heavy synthetic product. So we have to figure out, how do we get cotton into that? We can't give up on that, because if that's where the trend is going, then we got to be there. If that's what people are buying or looking for, we got to get cotton in there. So those are some examples, you know, in the apparel market where we're going to make decisions based on what we think the overall probability for success is. Or we may work with some smaller brands because they might be up and coming brands. And people are looking at those brands as kind of market leaders. So we do a lot of work actually with some smaller companies because we think they're smart, they're entrepreneurial, and they're on the upside of the curve. So working with them before maybe they're big name actually is a good thing for cotton to become a leading edge material. So there are different reasons that go into it. But the key point, again, to your question is, the key point for us is there's a deliberate strategy behind who we work with and who we don't, where we're going to allocate, you know, marketing dollars or, and very importantly, people's time. So we look at all of those things to really determine where's the best return for cotton.
It's Mark Masura, head of the Global Supply Chain Marketing Division at Cotton Incorporated. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
When you want to create a sell contract, a futures contract, a spot contract, we're able to answer a series of questions. We're able to involve the banks, lien holders. We're able to involve landlords and partners. We're able to involve brokers and everyone in between. And we're able to put all the conditions of the purchase, whether they're premiums or discounts based off of moisture or quality or foreign material or whatever it is, you're able to put all of those variables in by answering simple, simple questions. And we create the most formal ironclad contract you can believe. We're able to do this by connecting it to all of these data points, and we're able to execute them instantly.
The CEO of Grain Chain, that's Louis Macias, talking about how blockchain is an answer to an ag question.
What we're doing is changing the way things work, and we're doing it in a way that's easy to use. I've been in the software industry for 21 years, and I married into the farming industry 11 years ago. My father-in-law is a very large-scale grain farmer, and he asked me, find a solution that works. I've always had a concept of creating a big red button approach. If it's harder than pushing a big red button, nobody's going to use it. We've been working at different aspects of this software, and so has the rest of the industry. It's been waking up to the need and the want to be able to create not only a transparent but digitized process when it comes to production. And if we want to maintain sustainability and we want our kids to get into this business and we want to grow our business, we need to be able to understand what the markets are like. And we need to be able to compete at the levels that are above our part of the chain. We need to understand that systems can calculate and think about all of the different variables in a truly efficient manner. And that gives us the ability to work the way we do. We have to be able to create a level of incentivization to be able to make this work. Other countries are doing it to where they're incentivizing us to do good work, making sure that we're taking the right processes. We're doing it with carbon credits. This process is only going to grow. The more digitized you are today, the more ready you are to implement these processes going forward. And with the technology that we are able to apply to this, it gives us not only an edge, but it wakes us up and reminds us sometimes. It tells us what's out there, and it gives us the ability to be strong when we're negotiating and when we're selling. But the best part of data is the lowering of risk. is the better loan rates, the more aggressive insurance we have. Imagine a day where we can create an insurance policy within seconds, and when it actually needs to happen, when something bad does happen, we can claim our insurance within seconds. We're doing this today. The ability to create a loan product at the beginning of the season and be able to adjust that loan product throughout the season because items of data have changed, pricing has changed, situations have changed. Having the ability to aggressively use this data to lower your bank's risk, to lower your insurance company's risk, and to provide this data in seconds, to make a claim with the push of a button, to get paid within days instead of weeks, to be able to create a very efficient process with this.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
You know, it is kind of contradicting there, especially when you look at the feeder cattle market, right? As we've seen, feeder cattle were higher this week with another uptick in corn prices. You know, I don't think those are necessarily detached, but I do think, you know, we're seeing relatively strong demand for cattle. And I would say really that's driving that market, just being the optimism there.
Lee Schultz is an Iowa State livestock economist.
And this isn't the first corn price surge either, right? So I think we're seeing maybe a little bit less reaction to that feed market. Now, that's not saying that's not important and we're going to see cattle prices reflect that. But I think that just points to the overall optimism as we look at cattle.
And he looks at current cash bids across Kansas.
Well, we just haven't seen anything like this. At least I haven't in my lifetime now in this type of a position. Now, we've seen major run-ups, of course, during the 2012 drought, summer of 2012. 2007, 2008, we'd seen a major run-up in the spring-summer months in commodities. During Chernobyl, again, that involving Ukraine in years past, we saw a one-time quick spike and then a quick drop-off once we learned the true extent of what the risk was and damage was. So at least we can say that now we're at another time of tremendous price inflation. And we've seen, following the prospective planning report released by the USDA on March 31st, we've seen corn futures up almost every day since then. I think there was one day when it wasn't. But when you look at the chart movement for Dees corn, you see that going higher. November soybeans have held their own, but they haven't been running up the same way. It sure seems like, given the results of that report from the USDA, that the general market has seen fit to try to bid for corn acres. And when you look at the ratio of new crop bids across Kansas, the first thing you notice is that, wow, what a bunch of variability. But I just kind of say the relative prices for new crop bids for about six locations across the state and what the ratio is. And remember, a neutral bid is about 2.3. And 2.3 ratio of November futures for soybeans to December futures for corn. When you look at Colby starting in northwest Kansas, a new crop bid for soybeans at 1397, for corn 720, a ratio of 1.94 favoring corn. Then you go to Salina, north central part of the state, central north central, new crop bid 1647 is what I had seen listed off of DTN for fall delivery. 1647, new crop corn 716, a ratio of 2.3. So that's almost neutral, but that's a strong bid for soybeans. When you look at Topeka, $14.52 is a bid for beans, 705 is a harvest bid for corn, 2.06 favoring corn. Then you go to Garden City, 1407 for soybeans in Garden City, and 765 for corn. By far and away the best bid as far as the region goes in the state, a ratio of 1.84. Clearly favoring corn in Garden City and Colby. Hutchinson and Columbus, both with ratios of about just right around two, they're also favoring corn right now as opposed to that. And of course, a lot of that's affected by whatever basis as local elevators bring to corn and then the run up in these corn futures relative to November soybeans. So we've got this, yet we're coming into a season where almost nowhere in the state, maybe a few places in the south or southeast corner, we have a little bit of corn planted, maybe. We are in April. We're mid-April, so it's going to start to happen in earnest here. But in the midst of trying to get crops in, trying to have adequate inputs, top dressing nitrogen, if we still need to do that, whatever we have to do, we're looking at a lot of economic incentive in Kansas anyway, in most areas of the state, to increase corn acres over what had been projected in that March 31st prospective plannings report by the USDA.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
On his first day in office, President Biden signed an executive order directing government agencies
to advance equality and racial justice throughout our federal policies and all our institutions.
And directing agencies to create plans to do that. And on Thursday, the president told a special equity discussion at the White House.
Today, I'm proud to report that more than 90 federal agencies, including every cabinet department, are releasing more than 300 concrete and intentional actions to address systematic barriers to prosperity, equality, opportunity, and dignity everywhere.
Among those agencies, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, its Secretary Tom Vilsack said the 20 mission areas of his department have identified
525 specific actions that we intend to hold ourselves accountable in order to advance equity at USDA.
He said USDA also has formed a special equity commission to make further recommendations to create a culture at USDA
that puts equity in front of everything we do.
This is Gary Crawford, Washington.